Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 12, with Sven Franke and Will Alazawi joining Joran, Louise, and me to consider what failures have taught us about drug development, particularly if the success of the Resdiffra launch. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last September about differences between how we would use NITs to evaluate patients for trials versus evaluate the efficacy of drugs in an individual patient. This conversation continues the discussion around patient recruitment and efficacy endpoints. Sven Franke starts by discussing how much larger the drug effect for Resdiffra looks if we add lack of fibrosis progression to regression in creating the efficacy endpoint. Will Alazawi agrees, but notes levels of other metabolic diseases will also have an impact on how to assess a drug's performance, and that we do not adequately control for this in trials today. Joran Schottenberg and Will discuss the value and meaning of stabilizing type 2 diabetes in relevant patients. Sven goes on to note that the purpose of a clinical trial is different than the goal of clinical practice. Will agrees and suggests this might be a reason some trials fail. At this point, I shift the conversation from 2023 by asking what we learned since 2020, when Joran published his paper. Joran points to two specific areas where the field has improved: greater consistency in reading biopsy results, and a tendency back then to rush agents into clinical trials, later stage clinical trials, in fact, without sufficient consideration of pretrial data and even complex early trial results. Will notes that trials that reported in 2020 were actually designed in the earlier mid-teens, which means they could not take advantage of the innovations described in the 2020 paper or even what we had learned in the 3 or 4 years before that. He goes on to point out that the failed trials produced data that served as the foundation for analyses from consortia and other groups, and Sven goes on to commend the companies themselves for producing this data and then digging deep into their results to find insights even after failure. Having an approved drug changes lots of things for the better, but not everything. This conversation considers some of the issues we've yet to resolve. So just sit back, listen, enjoy, learn. When you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Sven Franke.
Going back to what Louisa said about also the relevance of the response rate, I think also for, but it's getting back a little bit to what we already discussed, and that with, for example, with resmetirom, you can say, okay, if you just look at fibrosis regression, you have only 11-12% effect size. But if you take into account those that do not progress, you get an effect size of more than 30%, 33-35%. And so it illustrates that if you look at the total picture, that you get better efficacy data. And I think in terms of the cardiovascular mechanisms that Will alluded to, we should not forget that if people are well controlled, for example, with aspirin, with statins, and so on a very long run, even those drugs, they will never hit the endpoints that we define for a MASH trial, but they do have a benefit also for the liver in terms of disease progression and going to cirrhosis and cirrhosis decompensation. So we have all interest in making sure that their cardiometabolic risk factors are treated optimally and then tackle also deliver problem.
William Alazawi.
No, but I totally agree your point. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you've got a patient, like for like, one with poorly controlled diabetes and one with well-controlled diabetes, then the likelihood that that person will end up in a position where their biopsy shows that they've got active NASH and fibrosis is different. And therefore, if you like, their likelihood of trajectory moving forwards in the short time frame of a trial, be it 1 year, 2 year, whatever, they are also going to be on different trajectories. So absolutely agree with you. Definitely, those medicines aren't going to touch those endpoints, but it might be that they have created a different, if you like, substrate in which the drug is being tested.
No, you're absolutely right.
Joran Schottenberg.
I mean, the important point, and Will, not sure you meant that, is for the clinical trials, of course, we look for stabilized patients, right? So poorly controlled, we're going to have that in real-world clinics where there is not an optimization, maybe, and then the drug effects could be different, potentially better, because you have more ability to bring down the glucose resistance. But typically, the ones we include in the clinical trials should be stable the best we could get it. And then, you know, they could still go different trajectories, but they would have been stabilized before enrolling.
They'll be stabilized by the parameters that we measure, by their HbA1c. And of course, glycemia alone, as the diabetologists are finding now, and I'm a total amateur on this, but I would say, but when I hear the diabetologists speak, glycemia alone isn't the only marker of outcome. I see what you're both saying. I just wonder that as we have more and more people on SGLT2s and GLP-1s, whether we're going to find that some of the medicines that have maybe under-recruited patients taking those medicines are going to, we're going to find a different effect once they're out in real life. Totally agree. We're going to have to wait until we're out in real life before we answer those questions. But I think who's going into the study is really important. And certainly, I mean, you both recruit very heavily into these trials when we recruit as well. There's a long list of people who we look through who we never really consider even screening them at the pre-screen rate. So they're never measured on the pre-screen fails. So it's really important to consider who is it that we as the investigators are pushing into these trials, because, you know, there is a selection here that's ongoing.
Yeah, but I think that we also often forget, and not only we, but probably the field also, the purpose of a clinical trial is different than the purpose of routine clinical practice. In the clinical trial, we really want to demonstrate that the drug itself has an efficacy. And when it then comes to using that drug in routine clinical practice, it's not so much a problem that the patients are not exactly the same as the very well stabilized patients in the clinical trial, because the purpose is different. The purpose of the trial is really trying to show the added value of the drug, because it's always a risk to take a drug. So you also need to demonstrate the benefit, and therefore you need more selected and stable patients in the clinical trial. I don't see really the disconnect between the more strict environment of a clinical trial and then the more broad replication in a more heterogeneous population, etc. I don't think personally that the patient population in whom we eventually use the trial need to be strictly the same as in the clinical trial. But of course, they need to have the disease, but it's about demonstrating the efficacy and so justify the use of the drug.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I guess all I'm trying to go back to is, because the original question of today's conversation is, why have the drugs failed? Or are we to be disheartened by the fact that the drugs have failed? And I think sort of being critical of how we've included patients in the trials may be one explanation. That's kind of what you touch on in your paper.
Yeah, and the background therapy is, as you say, is continuously evolving, and it's now different than the trials we did 5 or 10 years ago.
Roger Green.
So let's go back a little further than that and see, what did we learn between 2020 and 23 about how to do things better? And what can that tell us about what else we need to learn now? So Joern, I'm going to ask you.
I think the world of clinical trials in the indication of fibrotic MASH has clearly changed a lot since then. The first graveyard article I did, it was with Joost Drent, and you mentioned 2020, so it was looking at drugs like cenecrivirock, and the selonsertib was out recently, and I'm probably forgetting some of which we covered in there. I think we took a totally different approach in terms of pre-screening, selecting the patients, and reading the endpoints. So by now, we spend a lot of work on refining the way that the two endpoints, MASH resolution and fibrosis regressions, are read consensus among pathologists, not based on a single read. And a lot of things have changed since then. The other thing is that in the initial enthusiasm in the field, there was a lot of MOAs rushed into clinical trials that, after consideration and careful consideration of the preclinical data, you would have probably taken a little slower approach and might have avoided some unnecessary trials. But it was a little bit of a gold rush in the early 20s.
I think that's a very important point. I cannot agree more. I think that one of the reasons for failure of some of the trials is indeed the true lack of efficacy, and that's with those mode of actions and preclinical data, but not always very robust phase 2 human data to go further into the large phase 3 trials with 1,000 or 2,000 patients. Absolutely agree.
I think that's right. One thing I will say, though, is at that time, though, we were looking at the readout of trials that had been designed 5 years earlier. So there was a time lag. There was a sort of a necessary time lag that people in other disease areas didn't have to have, because certainly those first trials had quite a high activation energy needed to get going because of some reluctance in the field. There was some nihilism. You know, we only really had the NASH CRN trial design to go on. So there'd been quite a bit of a lead up to delivering those trials. And although looking back, one might say, yes, that we've probably should have had a closer look at that phase 2 trial before embarking on the phase 3 or earlier, I think we learned an awful lot. And I think that it's possible that the field would have been criticized for making too many assumptions without going through some of those studies. I mean, for example, knowing about the rate of progression, which we're back to progression now, knowing the rate of progression in the selonsertib trials, the F3 and the F4 trials, knowing those rates of progression in 2,000 patients, I think gave us a real insight insight into what the trial population, so people with F3, F4 with NAS scores that were elevated, how that goes ahead, as an example, I think is really informative. And although I'm sure investors and pharmaceutical companies don't necessarily want to run multi-million phase 3 trials in order to learn the natural history of the disease, we learned an awful lot as investigators, I feel, from those. So failure, of course, because not achieving the primary endpoint, but in terms of us learning and making the subsequent trials better, I think definite takeaways.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Will. I think we should also acknowledge the effort of some of these companies to really dig into those data sets of trials that were reported to be negative. But some of them did not stop it there and have put those data sets available to the community with very relevant information that has really helped us and have advanced our understanding of the natural history of the disease. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In that regard, it was not a waste of energy.
We're clearly visionary enough to get us kick-started and actually at the place where we're at today.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. Next week, we will preview Global Fatty Liver Day from the Global Liver Institute, which will fall on June 13th. We'll have several patient advocates and at least one physician champion with us. Until then, stay safe, surf on, say a prayer for our departed colleague, Stephen, and his family, and we'll see you next week on the podcast. Bye-bye now.